Thank you. Last week we noticed that, or we noted that the approach we were taking was to think about 1 Corinthians as 5 essays. We did two of them last, whoops, we did two of them last year. Hang on a second. Let's just see where we... it seems to have a mind of its own at the moment. Can you just click the... Right. Yeah, okay, that's the beginning. Nope. Okay, thank you. Okay. So last year we did a couple of these essays. We're just starting to look at the opening essay of the letter where Paul talks about the cross and Christian unity. And that's what we're moving into. So we're going to start by perhaps looking at somebody who you may not think of as being somebody particularly erudite or highbrow. We're going to start to think about Brucey. Those of you who didn't go out to look at to watch the Uganda slides will have seen some stuff on Strictly, a tribute really to the entertainer who died recently. And what I want us to do is to think about something that's quite difficult, but it's quite central to the book that we're studying, 1 Corinthians through. The book by Ken Bailey is about structure in a big way. And one of the structures is something called the chiasmus, or they sometimes talk about chiastic structures in the way that things are written. And basically, Brucey had several of these in his sort of catchphrases that he used. Rather simple examples, but examples nonetheless. And we've got one there, which is, "Nice to see you, to see you nice." And you can see that the first and the last line have got the same theme. In fact, they're exactly the same word. It's a very, very simple example of a chiasmus. "Nice to see you nice." Now, I haven't gone through and vetted all of his phrases that he used, his catchphrases, so perhaps you can do that before you yell them out. But what other sort of catchphrases can you think of that might be appropriate that Bruce Forsyth used to use? "You're my favorite," okay? Not a chiasmus, but yes, "You're my favorite." What else? "Didn't he do well?" Yeah, very brief, not a chiasmus. There's any others? What other ones? "Good game." Okay, so what was the other one that went with "good game, good game"? Pardon? "Lots of fun at the end." There's another one that went with... how does this one finish? It's a chiasmus. "Points mean prizes." What do points mean? Points mean prizes. So it reverses back on itself. And a very, very simple example of the sort of structures that Ken Bailey says there are just loads of in 1 Corinthians. In fact, the first thing that really drew him into moving away from a traditional view of 1 Corinthians as a sort of a scattered letter that was just sort of written in haste to something that's really, really structured is the way that patterns repeat back and forth. And there's this sort of sandwich pattern. Sometimes it's not just a pattern with one bit in the middle. Sometimes it's sort of like a Big Mac. There's sort of several different layers all in the middle there that reverse back on themselves in the thinking. The way that he structures this letter, the first essay that Ken has got, he sees that as a chiasmus as well. That we start by looking at divisions in the church. Next week we'll start to look at, or the week after actually, I think it is, start to look at God's wisdom and power, where? In the cross. The week after that, same sort of theme, God's wisdom and power, where? Revealed through the Spirit. And then back again to the question that he starts off with, which is the fighting and the disunity that there is in the church. And he sees this structure over and over again. And so the challenge for people who have to stand up here and sort of preach from a book that we've been given by John Shepherd, basically, to work on, is that somehow we have to make this exciting, and we have to communicate what the challenge is and why you should bother about all of this kind of structural stuff. Why does it matter if there's structure in there? Can't I just read my Bible and let it speak to me? And the answer is yes, you can. But structure is important in lots of other areas of our lives. And yeah, if we're not going to talk about structure on a Sunday morning, then probably you won't be interested in structure in any other part of your life. So is structure too technical for us to talk about? Well, yes it is, provided you never want to knit a pair of jeans for your grandson. And knitting is a massively structured exercise, isn't it? You take these sort of long threads and you turn them magically into hats and jumpers, and in this case, a little pair of microscopic jeans. Very, very structured. And the people that knit, they sort of internalize all this structure, don't they? They're watching the telly and they're knitting. They're watching a game of football and they're knitting. Sometimes they come to church and they're knitting. And they're counting up the whole time. There's massive structure involved in turning a long strand of wool into something that's shaped like that. If you're not interested in structure, then you're never going to be able to do something like that. Structure's too technical to talk about if you're not interested in ever listening to any rap music. I don't know whether you like rap or not. My son Nathan bought me a copy of Hamilton, the rap musical, for my birthday. I say bought, I think he ordered it on Danny's Amazon account, so he chose a present for me to listen to. As you listen to rap, you realize that there are some fiendishly complicated rhyming schemes that work back and forward, and the rhythm is super complicated. And out of a sort of one of the popular genres has come this very, very highly structured stuff. And the musical, I don't particularly like it. I like something where a musical sort of gets going and has a really good thump and everything. And all the time with Hamilton, you just think it's about to get going, and then it's back into something that's incredibly detailed and references all kinds of other things that are going on. That kind of stuff you won't understand, and indeed you won't understand any other music if you don't spend some time trying to understand the structure, the structures of the rhythm, the structures of the chords, the structures of the rhymes, the structures that go together to pull everything together. Structure's too complicated to talk about if you don't want to ever watch a game of football. You need to know the structures that lie behind it. As Danny and I were parking this morning, the car in front said, "I follow the Owls." And it was SWFC. And I was thinking, which owl goes with SWFC? And I went down the back and I just asked Graham. And Wayne said, "Oh, that's Sheffield Wednesday, the Blades." And of course, all those different connections you only know if you followed football closely. I remember a mum whose sons, this was a long time ago, were Derby County fanatics, the two of them. And at some stage, the number 9 came up, and the mum said, absent-mindedly, "Number 9, Nigel Clough." And I realized that, you know, out of this structure thing, it sort of internalized itself in her. She connects numbers in ways that other people don't do. And footballers do it all the time, don't they? That invisible offside line, that it's not really there at all, because even 6 hours after the game has been finished, they'll still be arguing about whether there was enough of the person over the ball and what was going on in that person's head in order that they were or were not offside. And yet that occupies a huge number of neurons for a huge number of people on a Saturday afternoon and evening. It's all about the structure. And in fact, structure is too technical if you don't want to do anything. Almost anything you want to do in life, there are rules and structures that the insiders know and the outsiders don't. If you want to speak another language, the grammar is all about structure. If you want to drive a car, it's all about structure. You know, if you maneuver before you look in your mirror, you know, terrible things can happen to you. And it's all about structuring what you do in the right sort of way. If you want to read a novel, you know, they don't tell you at the beginning whodunit. You know, you only find that out, and they give you clues as you go all the way through, because that's how you structure novels, particularly whodunits. You want to decorate your house, you have to do this bit before you do that bit. You want to write a letter. Paul starts his letter by telling us who he is. If you write a letter today, you say who it's to. And then you sign at the bottom. We have structures about the way you don't jump in to things with the main body of your message. You usually say, "How are you? I am fine," or whatever, you know, depending on how eloquent you are or lack of eloquence you possess. Then you will sort of spend some time trying to make friends with the person that you're writing to. You want to survive at work, you want to survive at home, you want to walk, you want to talk, you want to do anything in life, there are rules and structures to it. And all I want to encourage you to do is just to realize that these letters have been thought about with incredible detail. The people that put the New Testament together that wrote it, people that wrote the Old Testament as well, were using thought patterns that were incredibly complicated and really elegant. And if you understand enough about structure to knit anything more complicated than a scarf, or to watch a premiership game, or to listen to any piece of music, then you know enough to sit down and to try and work out what it's about. And so as we look at the book of 1 Corinthians, it's worth getting Ken Bailey's book about Jesus, about Paul through Mediterranean eyes, and just reading it a little bit. It's quite heavy stuff, so you won't read it all in one go, and you won't read it like a novel. That's the other thing. Books like that you tend to dip into, just like we're dipping into the book, and you read a little bit because it is quite heavy going, but it is worthwhile doing. So the first question is Paul just answering random questions? We've had Paul saying, my brothers and sisters, some from Chloe's household have informed me that there are quarrels. And he seems to have picked up some news. As we said, he's moved on from Corinth. He's probably in Ephesus. And he's got this news following him about things falling apart. And there seem to be a number of issues. But the thing that Ken Bailey points out to us is that in Ephesus, Paul is teaching every single day. He's renting a lecture center and he's preaching to whoever will come in from about 11 o'clock in the morning till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And as part of that, he's getting his ideas about the Christian message connected up. And Ken Bailey's idea is that out of all of this, Paul's been thinking about these questions and saying, how can I do more than just answer the questions? How can I be like a mother of pearl shell that sort of when the grit comes in, the mother of pearl doesn't, the oyster doesn't just spit it out. It sort of coats it in layer after layer of beautiful material until you get this wonderfully structured thing that we drill a hole through and put on some strings and wear because of the beauty of the pearl. His argument then is that Paul is thinking about the problems, and each of these five essays is attempting to answer one of the questions. But he's not going to just answer the question. He's going to try and get you to think about it. He's going to try and wrap it up in a very, very elegant way. So, big challenge if you believe that. And I'm persuaded by Ken Bailey. And while I'm up here preaching from his book, I'm quite happy to be a complete believer in what he said. Okay, I think it's a really helpful way of looking at the book. But the challenge that you face is why does he then go off on a wander? He says, verse 14, he's starting to talk, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? Okay, that sounds really structured. He's going somewhere, and then he goes off piste. I thank God that I did not baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius. So no one can say that you were baptized in my name. Then he says, yes, I also baptized the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I don't remember if I baptized anyone else. Now, whatever else that is not a piece of a structured argument, okay? That's not chiastic particularly, right? For some reason, and he's probably dictating it, we heard about his handwriting from Tony, I think, last week. Probably he has a problem with his eyes. That's what some people have said, because in Galatians he said, look how big the letters are that I'm writing with. He writes with huge writing, with huge letters. So probably he's struggling. So he's dictating this. And as he's sort of dictating to Sosthenes, who's the chap at the start, who's probably the one who's writing it, the scribe, he sort of just gets lost. He just goes off and he starts to say, you know, I baptized this one and that one. Not very many at your church. I did baptize some people from Stephanus' household. I don't remember anymore. What is going on there? Well, as Baptists, this is an interesting verse because it's about the only one which has got a word no or not in connection with baptism. The New Testament is really very, very positive about baptism. So what is it that Paul is saying when he said, I didn't baptize? He said, Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach. What are we to make of that? Is that because it's not part of the structure? Does that mean we just ignore it? Or what do we do? And I think what we do is we just pause for a minute and think, what is it that Paul is trying to tell us in this little diversion. I think one of the things, and you may go away and think about it, you may, hopefully you'll discuss it when you tear the sermon apart at lunchtime or whatever you do, please discuss this and tear this bit apart and really try and make it into something that means something to you. He says, Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. I think it's important, particularly the more mature you get in your faith, to know what it is that God has really gifted you with and prepared you for. What is it that you're really going to do? What is it that God has given you special gifts to be able to do? Because there will be things that you really can do. And one of the things about growing in your ministry is to get a sense of confidence about, that's me, that's what I'm good at. And the flip side of that coin is to learn the things that I'm not good at. And not even the things that I'm not good at, the things that I'm not quite as good at as the one thing I'm really good at. Now, I don't want to push this too hard, because it's easy for us as Christians, it's easy for me to say, I'm not going to do anything I don't want to do, right? Okay, I'll do this in church and I will never do any of these other things, okay? And I think if it goes that far, it's wrong. But I think at the same time, we can be drawn into doing all kinds of things because there's a need for that stuff to be done. And sometimes it distracts us from doing what we're really good at or what God has really called us to do. It's a difficult idea, but it is something that's worth some thinking about. And Paul is saying here, even something as important as baptism, I was called to preach. That's my job, to explain the gospel, to make it clear to people. That's the one thing I can do really well, and that I will do even if it means I'm not going to do other important things. And as we can see here, the fact is people were lining up behind the person who baptized them, and they're saying, you know, I'm in this person's particular brand of Christianity. And Paul's saying, fortunately, I didn't baptize many people, so I'm not going to be a diversion in that way. So what's the big problem that's going on? Why are they arguing? Why are there fights in the church between different groups of people? And the answer is that there are sort of three very different cultures that are in this church. This church is a church in a Roman colony. I think it's on the Greek side, isn't it, of the divide. I think Corinth is in Greece. Who's been on their holidays to Corinth? Yeah, is it? It's on the Greek side. Yeah, it's Greek. So there's a lot of Greek culture, and Greek was the sort of the English of the day. Greek was the language that everybody spoke in. Whatever your home language, Greek was the language that you did that you spoke and transacted business in and stuff like that. And then, but the church has been founded in a synagogue. And so there are a lot of people with a Jewish background. And for those people, the speaker that makes the most sense to them is Cephas, Peter, the Apostle Peter. He's very down to earth. He's the fisherman. He understands the Jewish mindset. He makes a lot of sense. And when he speaks, people love to listen to him. There are those with a Greek background there, as I've said. And for them, the star is Apollos, a really eloquent chap, a chap who knows his philosophy and his religion. He's just superb at all of this kind of stuff. And he connects it together in a way that really makes sense for the people who sort of were born and grew up in Corinth. He's the guy for whom the gospel makes sense in the world in which they live. And then there's Paul. Paul comes from Tarsus. Paul grew up in a Roman colony. Paul is one of those people. In Rome, the sort of the racial issue was sort of divided in a very different way from the way it is now. You were either a Roman citizen, in which case you enjoyed certain rights, or you weren't. And it didn't matter anything about your background. Didn't even matter. I mean, some Roman citizens started lives as slaves, right? It was a legal status that you got. And once you were a Roman citizen, you have that for life. And Paul, you know, remember that time? They're about to give him a whipping, and the Roman guards get him all ready to whip, and he says, by the way, are you allowed to whip a Roman citizen? And the guy goes crazy about that, because he realizes that he's overstepped the mark. He's done something which is a big taboo in that society. You do not whip Roman citizens. And he says, oh, I'm sorry. He said, I didn't realize that you were a Roman citizen. And the centurion said, I had to pay a shedload of money for my Roman citizenship. So you've got these three communities. Each one finds a different person easier to understand. They prefer that person's view of life. Now, what about in our church? How does that apply? Well, certainly, we're a very multicultural church. How does this sort of transition into our church? And I think the first thing we have to say is that in our church, we don't have that kind of open fighting, as far as I'm aware. It may happen when I'm not around, but I don't think there's that kind of open warfare. I think the cultures that we have are often quite interestingly connected. I'd just like to pick up three different events that happened on a Sunday morning. One happened just 2 or 3 weeks ago when an older woman, Jillian, brought a very young girl to the front to share in some activity that was taking place there. And I thought it was a grandniece or a granddaughter or something, but it wasn't. It was the daughter of the woman that was sitting next to Jillian, who hadn't come to this church at all. She was somebody who was a visitor, and she'd just pitched up. And the little girl wanted to go forward, and the mum didn't know what we do at this church. And so Jillian said, "I'll take her forward." And I think the connection between the age groups at this church is one of the phenomenally good things about this church. It's one of the lovely things that happens in this church. Last week, we had an older lady, she's younger than me, okay, a black lady who came and stood next to a young white girl, helping her through a difficult piece of explanation. And I think that the cultural connections in our church run very, very deep. The ethnic divides have got some lovely connections underneath. About a year ago, a year and a half ago, Dorothy was one of the deacons along the front giving out communion. And I think this will sort of illustrate the level of some of the connections that we have. And as she was sort of giving out communion, a tall white boy, the tallest there is in the church, came forward and went over to her. And she slipped him a note. And Danny and I were watching, and we thought, oh, I wonder what message Dorothy has got for Alex. He could probably do with a bit of encouragement at the moment. Anyway, we got a look at the note later on, and it said, "There's a tub of Jollof rice in the fridge out back." And of course, if you know Alex, that's one of the things that is really deeply appealing to him. And I think that at the level of food and at the level of communication, as a church, we communicate exceptionally well. And we have the strangest friendships, friendships that you would not expect to see coming together in other places. That's a great thing. And yet, I think at times, we tend to keep our distance and we're not able fully to pull things together as maybe we could. And I think that there's an encouragement as we think about this. We don't have open warfare. We don't have sealed communities. But I think that there's an encouragement to think a little bit more carefully about how we might make all of the richness that God has planted here really flourish and be fruitful. Yesterday, I was writing an email to a chap that runs a Christian organization in one of the large cities of our land. And they were just in the process of changing chairman. The guy that was chair had stepped down, a really faithful servant of God. And because this group is ministering in a very, very multicultural city, I was just trying to think through with him the challenge of making this organization, which is primarily white, primarily male as it happens as well, how do we make this organization more culturally diverse, and how do we get more of different types of people in there? And it's a really, really difficult challenge. It's one of the big challenges for us as Christians in this country. We have the amazing privilege of all kinds of diversity in our society. That's a blessing from God. All kinds of different ways of looking at life. How do we turn that into an effective witness that really reaches everybody in an effective way? So as we start to think about this first essay, there will be some challenges for us to pick up at different levels. So how's Paul going to answer the question? And in fact, if you bear with him, you may ask yourself, is he ever going to answer the question? Is he going to answer the question like Benjamin Franklin, when the American rebels were getting together to create what eventually became the United States of America? They were fighting against the British, and Benjamin Franklin said, and there were all kinds of divisions amongst them, and he said to them, he said, we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will all hang separately. And he's saying, you know, this is a matter of survival. Unity is a matter of survival. And is Paul going to say that? Is Paul going to say, you know, as a Christian group, you're a very small minority. Just forget about your differences because you'll never survive. Is that the line of argument he's going to take? Is he going to be like the Apostle John? I suppose mythology is too faint a word, but the things that I've heard is that as a very, very old man, they used to bring him into church and he'd say, the only thing he'd say is, children, love one another. And you see him transitioning towards that message if you read the three letters he wrote at the end of the Bible. The amount of content goes down and the repetition of the word love each other seems to go up by proportion. Is that what he's going to say? Look, love is what really matters. Just learn to love one another. Is he going to go all legal? Is he going to be a Baptist about this? Is he going to discover that there should be a rule that divisions are wrong? Being divided is morally wrong. Don't do it. Okay? And then, of course, you can divide over whether that's the right approach or not. Because, you know, we find different ways to divide, don't we, as to how we go about stuff. What sort of approach is he going to use? I was listening to the radio about 10 days ago, and Michael Howard was being interviewed. They were doing a sort of a life story of his experiences in politics. And there's a very, very famous encounter between him and Jeremy Paxman, in which Jeremy Paxman asks the same question about 18 times, I think. And Michael Howard, who's a lawyer, he sort of parries the question over and over again. And I thought it was because Jeremy Paxman actually wanted the answer. But it turned out the next guest on the TV program hadn't turned up yet, and he had to stall for about 20 seconds. And so he sort of just keeps asking the same question. And at times, we're thinking, is Paul ever going to answer this question? Is he going to answer it the week after next when we get back to this series? And he might start, but he's not going to finish it the week after next. And you ask yourself, is he going to answer it the week after that? And one of the things that Ken Bailey points out is the very elliptical path that Paul takes to an answer. He tries to get people to think about the problem from all kinds of angles before he finally answers the question. So Ken wants us to think about the letter. He wants us to try and understand it as something which has been carefully crafted. He wants some of us to put enough time in to understand the beauty and the glory of what the guy's done, and he wants all of us to appreciate that it wasn't just thrown down in 20 minutes as an afterthought. Paul wants us to think about our faith. He doesn't just want to answer the question, yes or no. And as your kids grow up, you see the same thing, don't you? You know, when they're about 2 or 3, no is quite a frequently used word by parents, and then the kids pick it up, don't they? And they use it too. And the sort of the yes and no bit is very important. But as they get older, you tend not to want to answer their questions in quite that way. And you tend to answer their questions with another question to get them to think about it. Somebody said, why do you English always answer a question with a question? Chaps said, do we? Anyway, the point is that so often we want people to think more deeply. And Paul wants you to think about your faith. He doesn't just want you to think about divisions. He wants you to think about the sorts of divisions that are real in your life, in my life, in our church, in our era. And there are two questions to take away. What are Christians supposed to do about divisions? How are we going to handle them? And that's for other people to answer later on. I'd just like to leave you with a thought. What are you called for, too? Do you really know what you're called to? Are you able to devote enough time to being really fruitful in doing what you're called to? And what are the things that you might have to not do in order to do the things that you're really called to? Thanks very much, Andy.